Hello and welcome to the Studio Mala podcast. Joining me this time is senior story artist Kayvon.
Hey, Owen. Hello.
You gotta tell me, well, not me, everyone listening doesn't know, I definitely know. But for the people who don't, what does a senior story artist do?
Well, you see, it's a very complicated answer, actually. I don't actually know myself. I've just been winging it for the past 10 years. Can I Google this now? Can I just quickly check on Google?
I mean, I want this whole podcast to have constant typing. Okay. Underneath it, like constantly checking.
Okay, that's it.
Because neither of us know anything.
That's good. I feel a lot more comfortable and at ease now. Now that you know nothing, I know nothing.
It's good of me to lie to make you more comfortable.
Thank you, Owen. But I mean, like, yeah. Well, a senior because I'm old. I would say, in respect, maybe to some people. But I mean, essentially, a story artist is someone who is knee deep in story, doing a lot of drawing, a lot of thinking about story, writing, just the crafting, you know, of a story in storyboard, usually, or story sketch format, creating ideas that might be, you know, coming across, whether it's in a cinematic for a video game or for a feature film or TV series. It's kind of like an everyman, I guess, that does a lot of. Just a lot of drawing and a lot of thinking about emotions and characters and story arcs and episodic stuff, you know, happening in a story.
What drew you to this kind of work?
I mean, probably going to sound like a lot of people out there. At one point in time, I was very foolishly wanting to be an animator, actually. I really wanted to do, you know, the traditional 2D stuff. And I was such a fool, such naive. I didn't realize how much work that was. And not to say that, you know, working as a story artist is any less work per se, but man, those animators, especially the 2D hand-drawn ones, and of course, yeah, CG ones, stop motion, that's a whole workload in itself that I just cannot comprehend, you know. I don't think my mind was built for that technical approach and grafting over a single scene. It's just incredible. But to keep it short, I was drawn to becoming a story artist through my love for animation. That's eventually kind of what led me there, the drawing part of it especially.
And what were the cartoons or animated films, what gave you that initial bug back in the day?
I think it was a mix of stuff, you know, like the really, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s animations. I mean, everything ranging from Tom and Jerry to Looney Tunes to, you know, the Disney feature films, the usual stuff that you got to see as a kid. But I mean, during the 90s, I'm not sure which VHS tapes they were. But at the end, they would have, you know, the extra special features where they would show the old guys behind the animation desk going, "Well, so you want to know how we make an animated cartoon, huh?" And then they show you the paper flipping and you'd be like, "Oh my God, this is moving. I need to do this myself." So it's that sort of seduction of that movement on individual pieces of paper that hooked me in, I think.
I'm going to reveal my age here a bit, but what you say about cartoons from 40s, 50s, 60s in the 90s, it does remind me that there seemed to be a great mix on television because they were limited to, certainly in Ireland, the two terrestrial channels, and they seemed to just put on whatever they could afford to get, which meant a lot of old stuff. But I suppose that was kind of good because I don't know if it was the same for you, but I was exposed to so many old things that I don't think a lot of people would be bothered with had they the choice of, like, strictly stuff that was being made right then. Like,
yeah, absolutely. Especially with, like, times changing and, you know, what people might think is, you know, cool now. But, I mean, like, you know, an ironing board hitting a cat. That was, you know, due to a mouse, I thought it was pretty good and it was well animated and stuff. But you're right, it's wondering how that sort of content kind of gets sifted through and kind of disappears when it was such a massive part of our childhood growing up. I mean, I don't know about you, but like I grew up on the outskirts of London as a kid, and during the 90s, they, you know, for a while, they were always re-releasing Disney movies into the cinema. So I think the first Disney movie I saw in the cinema was Snow White. My dad took us to see Snow White, and I was like, hold on a second. This film was made like almost 100 years ago. What is it still doing in the cinema? But Disney was, you know, really insistent on re-releasing the movies because, you know, they had such a massive impact on people.
Snow White is a great start.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good one. I don't think it was one of those ones that was my favorite per se, though, or even introduced me personally to animation. I mean, I think the big one for me was The Lion King. When I saw it's the first time I think I saw my dad cry was in The Lion King. So, you know, as soon as you see someone crying, you're like, oh my God.
The power.
Yeah, I can feel it in my mouth.
And that's when you decided, I'm going to harness that power.
Yeah, I can. Yeah, exactly.
I want to make dads cry in front of their children.
I can continue to manipulate.
A noble goal.
Yeah, exactly. It's horrible thinking about it that way.
The shot of the gazelles, it's probably not a gazelle, but in the gorge when they first went over, and it was kind of like early, I think some computer assisted effect, but in the cinema, holy moly. This ain't, I'd probably been watching Mr. Ben on television that morning, so it was a big step up.
Mr. Ben was cool. Mr. Ben was cool.
I've got Mr. Ben DVD downstairs. I love it.
Oh, wow. Amazing.
But that's, Mr. Ben is one of those things that was on when I was small that I think if I had more choice, I probably wouldn't watch something from 1972 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
I would probably be watching the most outrageous 90s in your face stuff.
Yeah.
But it was good in retrospect that I saw these other things, you know.
That's really impressive. I mean, I can't remember the last time someone even mentioned Mr. Ben. I think my maybe my mum used to watch Mr. Ben.
It's a good show.
Yeah, no, it's so charming. I mean, all that stuff, I think, from the past, especially the stop motion stuff, has such a charm to it. And it's really sweet to even look back on them. As I really loved Parsley the Green Lion. Did you ever see that?
Oh, yeah.
My gosh. Oh, I cry whenever you come on screen. Just like, he's so sweet.
Just the gentle air of television for children from that time.
Like, that's such a nice description. Gentle air. Yes, exactly.
They're so sleepy and just nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Whereas now sometimes you'll be like, wham, bam, 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 bam. It's like, okay, let me take a break.
Book. House. How did you first come to know about Studio Mala?
So basically, I actually found out about Studio Mala through Twitter. But I already knew who Sean was. Of course, through the Irish animation industry and sort of me just doing the rounds and being around, he was always there. He's always around at some point. And it's hard to pinpoint moments where, oh yeah, this was definitely the first time that I saw, you know, Sean. But I remember one time driving up to Dublin, or being driven up to Dublin by a friend of mine. We were going to an animation event happening that evening just before Christmas. I think maybe it was 2019. I can't remember now. And we were on our way up, and we called round to pick up my friend's boyfriend, and I think he was living with Sean at the time, and he just got into the car and passed me a post-it note that said, "Hey, Kayvon." He said, "This is from Sean." I was like, okay, I'm going to take this. And I took the post-it note in my hand, and I slid it, and I kept it away, and I put it in my book, and I use it as a bookmark for the journey, and I was like, I will work for this man someday. But yeah, no, I always knew about Sean. He was around, and he attended one of my talks before everything, you know, changed due to lockdown and everything. But he was always in the back scenes, like always knew he existed. But I had no idea, you know, that Studio Mala was a thing that was being created and concocted here. And I just saw the tweet one day, and I was like, oh my God. You know, telling everyone, like, did you see this? Because I think it's such a massive thing when you're living and working somewhere, you know who all the big hitters are. You know who all the big studios are and who's been there for a long established amount of time. So when, as soon as someone new comes on the scene, everyone's like, stop. Stop everything. Stop your scenes. Stop your animation. Everything. There's someone new on the scene, and this is so exciting. So I guess that's a double-sided question. So I knew Sean before Studio Mala, but then I didn't realize at the time that Studio Mala was Sean, and I had to sort of connect the blocks, and it was like, okay, cool. This is amazing.
It's nice you mentioned that, you know, there's a new studio in town atmosphere, because animation is so beautifully inherently collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it'll turn out I'm wrong as this podcast goes on and we have guests who come on to basically do wrestling style. Studio Mala, we're coming for you.
Yeah.
But I do feel like there is a respect and a support of everyone else who does this rather than competitive.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. But that's the thing, is I think everyone moves from studio to studio and gives their best, and they pick up lessons and you learn things from one place and you bring it to the next. And it's, I think that's part of the community of animation, like here in Ireland in general. It's just the way it works and the respect that everyone has for each other. It's not so much that competitive thing, like, yeah, like you're saying, it's kind of like, well, you know, at this moment in time, someone might be there, but what do they have to offer and what have they taken from those previous experiences? It's kind of like just like a pool of talent that keeps swirling around, and it's beautiful to know that, you know, there is that connection and there is that support going on between the studios, and it's super nice. But yeah, like you said, it's nice to have the new studio on the block with its hat and its gun, its holster and everything in it.
Everybody knows they can't do this by themselves, and anyone who has that attitude is probably going to hit a wall pretty soon. So people who are up for collaboration and working together are gonna thrive better, because you're not gonna make much animation by yourself.
You can
bang your head against a wall for years and then put something out, but at some point you're going to say to someone, could you color that in? Could you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's the thing, is though, I think that's what I love about animation personally, is that there is that collaboration, and yeah, knowing that no one can do their jobs without each other, it's kind of humbling. It brings you down to level and say, well, listen, I'm going to do my part of the job so well that, you know, everyone else is going to be proud of what they've created on, as a springboard that, you know, this department's done or that department's done. I quite like that sort of simmering and calming down of the idea of an ego in animation, because it doesn't really help, you know, one person being the inflatable balloon while everyone's just trying to wrestle by and get their stuff done. It's like, well, the finished product that we watch is not going to be split up into 100 different fragments. It's just one image on a screen. That's everyone's, you know, efforts together.
When a new project begins for you, what are the first steps?
I would say that kind of depends on, you know, when I might be coming in onto the project, because sometimes, you know, you might find that you actually start midway through a production, or you might find that you start in development at the beginning of, before production's even got the money it needs, you know, to actually become a thing, which has happened in the past. So, I mean, it always starts from a different point in terms of a production perspective. But for me, it always kind of starts from, what is this about? What is the story of this thing that I'm about to become a part of for the next 1, 2, or maybe 3 years or more? Like, what is this thing that I'm about to work on? And what is the story? Who are the characters? What are they feeling? What are they thinking? And what is the director thinking? What is the supervisor? These other people who are attached to this project and may have been attached longer than I've even existed or born, what are they thinking? Because this, I'm going to have to somehow channel it through in the work that I do for this project or cause or whatever. So, you know, the project starts, it can start as rough sketches, a lot of talking, and a lot of throwing away those sketches that I've done, and then more talking on top of that, and doing more sketches, and then actually maybe eventually doing some storyboarding at some point, you know.
I think it is very easy to sit and watch any cartoon or animated feature and not think about how 10 times, 100 times more than what you're seeing is in a bin somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. I think the part of you accepts that though. I think maybe the first, when you're studying at uni and you're figuring out storyboarding or you're being told by someone that this is all going in the bin, you kind of just accept that.
Is that something that you had to overcome, or were you pretty okay with it and understanding from the get-go that that's just part of how the professional world works?
I think I was actually really lucky to learn that very, very early on. When I was 15 years old, I interned as a runner and a graphic designer / animator. They got me to do these sort of idents or animated characters for Sky. And I was like, you want me to use Flash MX? I'm going to use MS Paint. So I did all these animations in the MS Paint. And then they were like, we can't use any of these. Because when they tried to put it on TV, it was just this pixelated mess. And I was like, damn. So they go all going in the bin. And they were like, yeah, it's all going in the bin. And I was like, well, I'm not doing that again, you know.
I love the idea of turning on Sky One some evening to watch the latest episode of The Simpsons and the Domino's pizza advert is BMP files just sliding around the screen.
Right? That could have been like a directorial debut. It's just,
That seems like exactly what Adult Swim would do as a kind of like, huh, how ironic.
ahead of my time. But yeah, no, I think I learned my lesson then. It was me being very close-minded, but even though it was just about the software that I was using, that extends to, you know, you storyboarding and pitching an entire sequence that has the character in a story doing something, and then the director coming and saying, well, the character would never do that, and then you saying, you know, you're right, put it in the bin. Because, you know, it's always for the greater better of everything. The story, the production, the characters, and, you know, what the purpose of the story is. So as soon as you realize it's the right thing to do, you're happy for it to go into the incinerator, essentially.
How do you bridge pleasing yourself and pleasing a wider audience?
That's such a complex question. My gosh.
You know, we can't just reminisce about Mr. Ben for half an hour. You know, I'm sorry, I gotta have to grill you.
Honestly, I'm happy to talk about Mr. Ben for half an hour. We should do a sit down and watch some episodes. Gosh, that's a really tough one, because I mean, when you're doing the job of a story artist, again, like I said, it's the better good of the story. It's not about you. It's you removing yourself completely. It's you using your hands and your brain to figure out stuff that needs to be figured out. But it's not about pleasing myself. I mean, you can be pleased with something you've done because you've accomplished it, but I feel, God, that's such a complex question, Owen. We need like a whole another 2 hours to answer that.
Any possible future guests are hearing this and suddenly they're like, wait a minute, I don't want to be in the hot seat here.
So. Yeah, be prepared for as
this
as
might be
question.
The last episode of the podcast.
I think pleasing yourself is kind of knowing that you've done a good job and you've done justice to your characters in the story that you're telling. So it's not a matter of it necessarily being like a personal thing, like, oh yeah, you know, I've done this thing on the side and I'm happy with that. That's me personally satisfied now. It's like, well, yeah, I actually managed to justify these characters and what they were feeling and thinking in this moment of the character arc. I'm pleased with this. You know, it's not like an external thing where I can look back and go, yep, that was pretty good what I did there. Well, no, it's not. You know, I think someone else could have done it, but you've done the legwork personally to reach that point of that part of the story or that idea in that moment. Yeah, sorry, that's just too deep a question. I just can't. I'm rolling over it in my mind and blabbing at the same time. It's so deep. You're constantly trying to please yourself. You're trying to draw your best, think your best, and make the best decisions you possibly can.
Seeing that the emotional beats or thrust of the story has landed in others.
Yes.
Is what is actually giving you the, that is what you wanted to bring to it. So yes, you are satisfied.
Absolutely. I think as a story artist, you're kind of seeing the success of your stories as long as it's landing with someone. Whereas if, you know, no one was bothering to see or feel any of the work that you're doing, it's almost pointless, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's how I wandered into storyboarding. I did the storyboards for my graduation film like 11 years ago. And I decided to muster up the courage to go and see the head of my course, a guy called Peter Parr. And I'd never actually sat down with him or shown him any of my work before. And this one time I thought, do you know what? I'm going to show him my storyboards, say that I've done it, get his opinion, go out and finish this film. And I showed him my storyboards and he said, wow, I can really feel the emotion in this scene. And he, without reading the script per se or anything like that, he described everything that I was feeling just by looking at my boards. And I was like, wow, someone gets me. So these feelings that I'm feeling as I'm drawing these drawings actually ends up somewhere. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a storyboard artist. Took the animation dream out the window. And this is it. This is definitely it. So yeah, absolutely. You said it yourself, you know, when it's landed, that's the feeling of being pleased and satisfied. Yeah, the job, I guess. Yeah.
Are there any films or shows that you might have seen in the last few years that have jumped out at you as, that's great story? They must have a hell of a good senior story artist.
Stop asking such tough questions. Oh gosh, I thought this was supposed to be casual, laid back, not be like a grilling of my story psyche.
we'll bring it full circle, don't we?
Okay. I find that too much of a difficult question to answer directly by referencing certain films, but I will say that I actually was introduced to, say, Studio Ghibli movies very, very late. Very late on in my life. And I say the late on, I mean like early 20s. I consider that late. When I talk about Princess Mononoke with friends and they were like, what? You didn't grow up with that? What the hell were you? And I'm like, what? Miyazaki's storytelling in films is that, as a body of work, stands out to me so, you know, so very much. It's difficult for me to really pick out and say that, you know, this individual story artist or story team's you know, efforts really paid off, because again, you know, animation is very collaborative. But yeah, it's too difficult for me to say like a movie of late. At the moment, I'm in the process of it's my first year voting for the Annies, the Annie Awards, and they give you access to, you know, so many films, and you have to watch these films before you vote for them. So it's the most films that I'm actually getting through, you know, in such a condensed time that I'm kind of like overwhelmed, but I'm like trying to be critical, and there's so much going on. There's so many great films.
And I think the standard in animated films especially is so high, because of course, you know, you have to have your story sorted before you dedicate so many millions,
yeah,
and all the time that's going to go into it. People generally don't very casually say, yeah, we'll see how it goes, we've got half a page here, you know, a couple of sketches, let's go for it.
But that would be the dream. That's almost like saying it's the movie or the project with the infinite budget, saying let's just storyboard for like 25 years and we'll have storyboarded everything that needs to be boarded, and we can just choose what's the best, you know, out of what everyone's done.
Well, I was going to ask you, what is your limitless dream project?
More difficult questions. I mean, the limitless, you know, boundless, amazing, infinite project from like a studio perspective. It's just one that the director wants to just try everything and go everywhere and experience, you know, have a mixed team of different experiences and just throw it at the wall and see what sticks, you know, that kind of project But if it was, say, in terms of a project that I say that I would like to do, I'm not going to tell you because I'm making it right now.
Oh my God, it's the first Studio Mala podcast exclusive. I want to see the comments just full of people theorizing, trying to piece together clues that might have been littered throughout the episode.
No, well, nothing's going to be said unless you sign the NDA, okay?
The thing that I have to do now, mm-hmm. that all interviewers do in this situation, is I have to lean in and say, can you tell us anything? Give us a colour. Colour. Doesn't even have to be associated. Just let people run with this colour as the the big clue.
Okay, the colour is green.
Ooh. Well, I think we all know what that means.
Do we?
Burnout. How do you avoid it? Do you avoid it?
I would say, so when you say dealing with burnout, it's kind of like saying, okay, I'm accepting that burnout is coming. It's kind of like a car, like coming veering towards you, or a train saying, okay, oh, hey, there's burnout. It's coming towards me. I think the first step to dealing with burnout is acknowledging it, that it can happen, and that by all costs, you should try and avoid it, if you so can. But animation is really special, and whether it's, you know, working for a studio, professional work, or it's for working on a personal project, you get so involved. You're almost addicted to the creation, to the magic of being able to see the things that you've created in front of you, finally materializing, that sometimes you don't really realize that you're beginning to get burnout, or the burnout has arrived and you're already way past it. So I think the best thing is acknowledging that it exists, being able to acknowledge and see it when it's coming, and calling it a day there, stopping it yourself and being able to say, hey, listen, I need to stop taking all these courses. I need to stop staying up till 3 a.m. Rationalizing it, saying, okay, there has to be a limitation to this, because at the end of the day, if you don't have your health, you're not going to make any films. You're not going to make any comics. You're not going to do any of those things. Imagining yourself in that debilitated state of not being able to do what it is you love really hits home.
I'm going to draw an oblique strategy card.
Please.
The next oblique strategy card is... try faking it.
Try faking it. Well, the first thing that comes to mind is... was it fake it till you make it, right? And I think you hear a lot of people saying that, say, in animation. And they're just like, yeah, just fake it till you make it, mate. Just, yeah, you'll be fine. You know, that's the only way to get in and break into the industry, blah, blah, blah. And I definitely think I'm guilty of faking it to a degree, because as a story artist, you're faking it every day. You're pretending to be someone you're not. You're pretending to tell a story that is, you know, usually fictional, it's non-existent, is created from nothing or from an idea, and you're trying to sell it. You're almost like a snake oil salesman of storyboards, and you're trying to get the best, you know, thing across and sold and made its way onto the movie without overselling it, and it being so good in the pitch that when you watch it in the movie, it's terrible. But I think faking it is a funny one, because you're doing that every day, both, you know, in the characters and the stories that you're trying to tell, as if you know that they existed and you're trying to get your audience to buy into it. But I remember before I even became a storyboard artist, or properly, you know, as a routine thing where every job thereafter was storyboarding, I remember being in an animation studio many years ago. And when anybody asked me what I did, I just turned to them and I just said, I do storyboards. And they were like, yeah, but you're not doing storyboards. I was like, no, I do storyboards. And I just kept saying it to everyone, even though I never even drew a single storyboard for that studio. By the time I was out of that studio, I was getting calls from people saying, hey, listen, we need you to do some storyboards. So I called myself what I wanted to be. When someone says to you, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" and I just said it so many times that, and I was faking it essentially, that ended up being that inadvertently. So, yeah, I've tried faking it and it kind of worked. It didn't mean that the journey wasn't difficult, because it was being thrown into that and trying to figure out actually how to storyboard on the job was pretty interesting.
I mean, I've been saying to Sean for months, I am the host of the Studio Mala podcast.
In a
And
questionable tone.
he would say, there is no Studio Mala podcast. But I just kept saying it until here we are.
That's it. That is exactly it. So neither of us would be here right now if we were not painting this picture of ourselves that was at the most
Because
moments in
we're
time.
liars.
Oh my
Because we
gosh.
lied. We lied.
Oh, I don't want to brandish other people as liars, but I like the word convincers.
What does it mean to you to see a completed project that you have been a part of?
I would say that it means a lot. Like, considering like just how much work goes into animation, it's just like every day working on one thing is leading just to a single day of you being able to see it and share it with everyone. So imagine if a production went for like a month or a year, 365 days. That's 365 days times the number of people that have worked across that project. That's hundreds, that over thousands of days. So upon seeing it on the screen and seeing it done, it kind of means everything, not just to me, but I think accounting for everyone else that's been a part of that, those exchanges that you've had, those moments that you've shared within the production and creation of something. It's not just, "Oh, cool, there's the tree that I drew in that scene. I remember drawing that." It's a kind of like a reflection of everything that you've gone through with those people, especially if it's a long time. It's like, wow, this is where it's landed us, and it's just an amazing, amazing feeling. It means a lot to me, but it not just. This is getting a bit deep, but not just. It's not just that time on the production, that means a lot to me, and makes me feel that, I'm very proud and inspired to see everyone's work to come together. But I kind of look back at the past and look at the stuff and the people that have brought me to this moment to be able to be a part of this project at this moment in time. There's this extensive long list of people that I have to thank, and my parents, who were storytellers in their own right, that inspired my character and personality, that brought me into this role to be on this project at this moment in time. Because when someone says to you, "God, I love your drawings and you're so funny when you pitch stuff, I want you to come and work on this project with this bunch of amazing people," it's kind of saying, well, I know I'm good at these things because these people in the past have handed me a part of themselves that's eventually ended up landing in this project, in this movie, in this TV show. Anything good that I have to offer, that I'm proud of, seeing that end on the, final thing on the screen, has been in the works way before I was even born, and leading up to that moment through, being grown up, growing up, being brought up, being read certain types of stories, seeing certain types of cartoons that, family or friends wanted to introduce to me growing up. So that's a really long-winded way of answering the question, but I feel so proud, like seeing that final thing on the screen, and I feel that it's so much more than just the production, just the moment, just the work. It's just the people, the individual experiences that have either led up to it, and the ones that I've shared with those on that project. Sorry, that was super long-winded and weird.
No, that was beautiful.
You can cut it. You can cut it. You can just hear me go and just say, "I
No,
don't
I'm
know."
sorry, Kim. That's actually the first thing I'm not gonna cut.
Oh,
That's gonna be the opening.
Oh, no. Everyone's like, "What? What are you talking about?" Well,
And I want to thank you very much for joining me on the podcast, giving me your time,
thank you for having me.
and your patience, I hope.
There was no patience needed. You've literally, you carried it all on your shoulders, and I've just been glad to be part of the ride. So thanks all for right. having me, Owen.
And I don't know how to.
Yeah. I don't know. You had some pretty smooth, like jazzy music at the end. That was kind of like, you know, the sort of coming off, like the curtain slowly closing.
Some yeah, good what I like polka. About that tune at the end is I can confidently just blabber away and fade my voice out as the music comes in, and I don't have to worry about having an